Blog Talk Radio.
The following program is brought to you by Firefly Willows, LIVE.
Hi, I'm Liz Addison.
Hi, I'm John Carosella, and this is A Shamanic Life. Welcome, everybody. I'm John Carosella, and this is A Shamanic Life. I hope you're enjoying your evening or wherever or whenever you're listening to our show. We have a slightly different format tonight. It's going to be a bit of a shorter show, but it's going to be packed with some very interesting information. So as we proceed, I just want to alert you to this is a show that I'm going to be doing a segment toward the end, the activist segment. I'm going to be bringing in some information from a premiere of Gasland 2, the new movie from Josh Fox about hydraulic fracking. And it was a powerful film, and it inspires and calls us to a broad call to action. And I want to encourage you all to stay and listen all the way through that segment. I went to see the film last night, and it was very powerful. But for the moment, let's dive into our featured guest conversation. I've got Liz Addison on the show tonight. I really enjoyed speaking with her earlier today, pre-recorded, and so let's just jump right into that. I'm John Carosella, and this is A Shamanic Life, and I'm here on location with our featured guest today, Liz Addison. Liz, and it rhymes with bliss. Liz Addison is an innovative composer. Circles of Light magazine says her music paves the way for a new genre of music. She's a powerful singer. Her last CD, The Grace of the Greenleaf, which I have and love, won Best Vocal Album of 2010 on the ZMR Awards. And she's a masterful dancer. Conscious Dancer magazine says her dance practice, Kivo, is a path to embodiment and self-realization. She is a passionate and visionary artist, performer, and teacher who is in service to the practice of music and dance as transformational tools. She is the creator of various families of healing chants or rhythmic vocal patterns, which she sets to her own compositions, and to which she creates choreography for the practice that she calls Kivo. And Kivo is the kinetic voice. Kivo, which she has taught in Mexico, Africa, and England, as well as here at home, is an embodied spiritual and healing practice, which also offers a practical foundation to help the repressed voice of humanity come forward, allowing one to be confident, grounded in their purpose, and in command of the very vibration they entered the world with. A skilled energy mover, she has had in-depth training and practice in the shamanic and yogic traditions and is a certified Akashic Records consultant. She offers group and solo sessions to assist others in not only producing accurate vocal resonance, but also in counseling to assist in their spiritual growth. It is with great pleasure that I welcome Liz Addison to the show. Welcome, Liz.
Thank you, John.
The domain of your work is quite broad, and it's fascinating to me. In particular, because of two things. One is the power that comes from the voice, and I love your music. That it just we shared your music from your latest album on the first episode of Shamanic Life Spirit, Muse, and Song segment, because your music is just so, it just gets me going. I love it.
Thank you.
And the other thing is your love of trees.
Mm.
And when I arrived today, I was delighted to hear you talk about and enumerate your trees. So let's start with your trees. You have a bunch of trees here in your home, on your home property.
Yep.
Tell me about them.
Well, we are sitting under the grandmother tree. Her name is Grace Ark, and she is the reason my studio, which we're sitting in, which is a yurt, is called the Singing Tree Studio, because she sings, she speaks to me, and I consider her a portal. She can broadcast healing energies all around the world. She puts a big net around the world and links all the healers' hearts. She sends a thread and is part of the net of light that holds us all.
When did you discover her capacity?
Well, we actually are living in the house, largely because of Grace.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, because we came in, it was this kind of dumpy little house that needed to be fixed up, and we looked into the back, and it was a huge backyard, and there she was. She took up about half of the yard. She's a big American walnut, and just stands open, and has a very beautiful core, like a cone in the center. And my husband and I looked at each other, it was like 15, 16 years ago, and we said, yeah, we can work with this place. It's really cool, because we have.
Yeah, that's great. And so how did she come to you as a potent being? Did she just, like, did you know it right away, or what was the story?
Well, she's quite a factor, and, you know, trees are great teachers to me. They're my totem. Well, I also carry bear medicine and otter medicine, but the tree teaches me to be rooted and yet transcendent. And really all of my work is about that. I believe as human beings we are both rooted and transcendent. We are of the mother, anchored into the mother, with our roots into the Mother Earth, with our crowns open, able to receive the radiant light of the divine. And it's this constant inpouring of that love and divine light down into the earth. And then we receive that and send it back up. So there's this constant flow in all the directions, up and out and down and up and out and down.
How does that inform your the creation of your music? You know, like there's a relationship between the cycle of the tree, you know, that what you just described, the flowing of the tree, and the flowing of energy in our bodies. And does that trigger your muse, or does that drive your music?
Well, I think so. I mean, to me, the spine and the shishumna, the energy current upon which the chakras reside, is like the trunk. And I have always felt a reception of the spiritual and the divine forces from the crown and in. And I very strongly connected with the Earth Mother, and I feel her energy and draw her into me as well. But when I receive information, and my first channelings really were music. I got a music download when I was 11.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, and it just, they fall into my head. It just feels like they fall into the crown. And I do a lot of work to keep my crown open and receptive to the divine light. And my last CD is called Crown in the Sky for that very reason.
Yeah.
We were like the tree.
Yeah. So share with us that experience when you were 11, if you can give us a little.
Oh, I was just sitting at the piano messing around. I had started taking piano lessons about a year before, and all of a sudden music appeared, and I started composing. And I was notating it and everything.
Really?
In those
really?
Days. Yeah, I mean, I notated for, oh gosh, a long time until I started studying electronic music in grad school. And, you know, about 20 years later, 15 years later. But now I don't have to do the notation, because the computer programs are so much more advanced, and I'm really facile with computer programs, and so I don't have to slowly notate my music. And that, I think, has really helped me become a better composer, because I'm not great at math, and in order to be a really good composer, like Mozart or something, you have to be able to write in fractions, you know, on the fly.
Yeah.
And I had to, it would take me a longer time. That was my weakest subject in school. I was a straight-A student, but not in math. And so composition, you know, I loved to also receive the information and then take a lot of time to organize it so that it made sense. And I think that's also helped me cultivate spiritual discernment.
Oh,
well.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, share a little bit about that.
So you don't just take in any information that you're given. You use your discerning ability to determine which is the highest and best for your growth and evolution.
And that manifested itself in your composition work, because you would hear lots of stuff and you would have to selectively emphasize or choose to reveal certain parts of it and not others?
Yes, however, the way I would put it is that music teaches you about itself. It teaches you what it is. And so it's a process of learning and
I want to hear more about that.
The
music teaches you about itself. Share about that.
It teaches me what it is. I don't know. I just remember in grad school, I would spend all day Sunday in my practice room. And a lot of times I would get the center of a piece. It would just come, it would fall into my head. I'd get the middle of a piece, I'd be notating at the piano. And then it would take me another 4 hours or something to get the measures that came before, to hook up with that. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I would get the core of the music first. But it would guide me. It would tell me where to go.
And do you think that process was the opportunity for you to co-create with the spirit of that particular piece?
Well, I think that's a really good question, because I have, in the last 7-8 years, become an Akashic Record consultant. And I've learned through work in the Akashic Records that the future's not fixed, and our lives are about our choices.
Right.
So, yes, I was making creative choices in those moments.
Right.
According to my interest and my taste, right, to have the music become...
Yeah,
so ultimately ended out.
So, like, you have a partner, which is this music, right? This music comes to you, the center of the piece, for example, and it says, it reveals itself to you and says, "I'm here. This is me," and then you figure out, you engage with it, and the other aspects of the song that you bring together. Are they your contributions to the partnership?
They may well be. I don't know if I can answer that, because sometimes they just come in.
Oh, sometimes they
completely
just come in.
Full.
The whole thing.
Formed. Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes in songwriting, lyrics come first. Sometimes melody comes first.
Yeah.
Some come more quickly than others. I find, though, that I'm a pretty experienced composer now. They come in pretty clearly.
Yeah.
And it's a kind of a process of winnowing and elimination. A lot of times for me, it's elimination.
Yeah.
Because I have a lot of ideas and a lot comes in and I need to start throwing out.
And what does that feel like?
I don't know. It's so endemic to who I am. It's just so much a part of who I am. And actually, I had a spiritual teacher who said to me that if I hadn't had music in my 20s, my life would have been much tougher, because it was also like a psychotherapy. I could go and work out the stuff and the feelings and the traumas and the issues, and it really helped me.
Has your music changed a lot over the...
Well, it's really funny you say that, because yes and no. I mean, I just wrote a song a couple of weeks ago for a client. I'm writing soul songs for people. So
right.
I open up their Akashic Records and then I receive a song. And it's like a portrait that they have, but it's also a healing vehicle for them.
Right.
Healing vessel, something they can listen to and connect with and feel good about where they've come. But it sounded like something I might have written when I was 16. It sounds like a folk song. And that was really liberating for me as well, because I've spent a lot of time, like the last almost 30 years, doing electronics and lots of recording, and the music is quite complex. And this was just a simple song with simple chords played at the piano, and I felt, oh, how refreshing just to do that.
Not a bad soul song if it's simple and clean like
really
that.
Really to the point.
Yeah, that's sweet. The soul song work that you're doing is connected to the Akashic Records work?
Yes, pretty much everything I do now is connected to the Akashic Records work. When I was 27, I was on a walk and met a friend. He did a healing, and when it was done, he said, "Okay, now I'm going to go to the Akashic Records and seal this." And I'm like, "What? What? Akashic Records? I want to do that. How do you do that? I want to do that." And it wasn't for another couple of decades later that my really good friend said, "You know, I met somebody who's doing work in the records, and I was so interested that I contacted the head of the organization, and she's coming to teach. I said, sign me up.
Uh-huh.
And I don't do a lot of that kind of just sign me up. I'm very careful with who I've
studied with.
Yeah. But it was very clear, and since then, this friend and I have both received our own prayers, so we have been gifted with our own prayers to allow us to access the Akashic Records. So this information is coming more and more readily available to us. Apparently, we abused the privilege and the power for centuries. The information was denied to us. And now, of course, since we're evolving so rapidly, this information is really important, and it's coming through more clearly. And the keepers were very much on me about developing Kibo and the kinetic voice.
What do you mean?
Well, you know, I'm a dancer, I'm a composer, I'm a vocalist, you know, I do electronic music, I have a recording studio, all that. And I'm this spiritual channel, right? And 20 years ago when my son was born, I asked for some healing chants because I wanted to have something that I could do with clients while the baby slept. So I always make this joke, like, well, she didn't ask for a breast pump, she didn't ask for diaper service, she asked for healing chants. Chakra healing chants.
Hey, that's okay.
Kind of describes, like, you know,
I know.
I'm really practical, right?
Yeah, I know.
So not only did I get the healing chants, which sounded very indigenous because we were on the medicine path and still on the medicine path, but I received totem animals along with. So I was able to practice these chants for a long time with clients, like 20 years. And I would just, you know, hit the medicine drum, and it would be very simple call and response. And then, like, 16 years later, I was working at a rehab center. It was all men, and it was a relapse rehab center. And initially, I was teaching yoga, and then they got wind of what I did, and they asked me to do a drum circle. So I used to do a monthly drum circle, and I came in with those chakra chants because I wanted to show the men a way to clear the energy body and the physical body with sound. And then we'd do the whole series, and they would be so buzzed. And it was really, you know, a rush for me to be able to say, okay, you don't need substance. You don't need drugs.
You can just generate that high through your natural system.
Absolutely. Through the body. And the voice is the body. So I used to think that they were going to think I was totally nuts. And especially when we got to the third eye one, which is... And I would think, you know, they're going to think I'm crazy, and they'd go, hey, can we do that BB watching? Because that was the one where they were really getting buzzed, because the third eye was opening. And that one I was given the totem of the dragonfly, and that comes back to the discernment that we were talking about, because you get a lot of information coming in, and the dragonfly has all these planes of consciousness being refracted off of its wings that are shimmering, all this light being refracted.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
It's a practice to become aware of your spiritual discernment, as well as opening the third eye, opening that, you know, reception and descent of the spiritual realm, but also being discerning about not taking in, you know, dark energies or negative energies or energies that don't have your highest and best of heart, or just some hitchhiker that's hanging around and wants to suck energy from you.
Yeah.
So that was really cool, because a lot of these guys were really spiritually sensitive, but they didn't have an outlet. Many of them came from the South, and it was very traditional, and they had very traditional families. They didn't have an outlet like we have here with all of our spiritual...
Were you doing that work here?
Yeah, it was in Marin, but a lot of them came from outside of the state. So anyway, that provided a really cool opportunity to work on these chants for about 3 years, and all of a sudden, right after I'd become an Akashic Record consultant, they go, hey, Liz, will you record these? And I'm like, well, duh, why didn't I think of that? You know, here I have a recording studio, I'm a composer. I never thought of recording these. So I went in the studio, I had my Akashic Records open, and the music that came out was so beautiful. That CD was the Song of the Tree.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That was the one.
So after I created that and realized from what I was hearing from other people, you didn't need to do the chants. You could just listen to the chants and then open the chakra system.
And that must be why I like them so much.
Maybe. I mean, it blew me away because I would be in this yurt. I couldn't sleep at night, and I'd come and be listening to the mixes, and I would just get blissed out, and I'd fall asleep listening to that CD. Mm. It really worked. After it was out and it was doing really well, playing all over the world, from Alaska to Zimbabwe, literally, healing centers and yoga, it was really cool. Then I heard the keeper say, move it, move the chant. And that's when
Kiva was born.
Yeah, so I took the healing chants. So the first family of tones is the chakra chant. Added five choreographic movements for each one so that it works the energy body with the sound and then the physical body. So you have the gross motor movement with the dance and the sacred movement, activating the physical body where the chakras reside, and then also using your voice to activate on the subtle level and a vibrational level with the chant.
Wow.
So that was the first family. And then I received another family of chants, body chants, and then started to just study this tradition around the world. I got really on to studying the tradition.
Really?
Yeah, because I discovered, you know, obviously this isn't a new thing. This is an old thing. This is what our ancestors have been doing forever, singing and dancing in community for healing, you know.
Right.
And so, of course, Africa, you know, the Americas, and I started looking for traditions that had the same word for song as dance.
Oh, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Like Hobina and Lesotho people in southern Africa have the same word for song as dance. There's a Mende word.
Where's the Mende?
Mende is a Yoruba word, but the Baka people in Cameroon, it's Bay. And there is this tradition because the Africans, kind of like me, I don't know, I'm wired the same way. When they sing, they have to move. And it's just a way of keeping the rhythm in the body, and the voice and the body cannot be separated.
So I want to ask you this question, but for you it's going to be hard to answer because it's so natural for you. For me, singing and dancing are not the same. My voice is way more willing to come out than, and has more, I have more gross and fine motor control over my voice by a lot than I do over my ability to dance. Now, why might that be?
Well, it seems to me because our culture has given us permission to do it that way. I mean, there are kids in Tanzania that learn a song, they go outside, they make a circle, and they sing it and dance it. I mean, it's just not that foreign.
Well, you know, I think, men in our culture don't really have the permission.
I know, and it's sad. Have you seen the haka?
No.
The haka is a chant that is done by the Aboriginals of New Zealand. And it's a chant that has body movements, and they do it before they go to war.
Mm.
You know,
right.
Oh, it's so powerful. It feels so good to do it. But not everybody's wired that way, I understand. So I start very simply, like, simply keep the heartbeat in the body.
Boom. Mm.
Right.
Okay.
Left. Right. Left. It's very simple. It doesn't have to be complicated at all.
Yeah, it helps those of us who are stunted.
I wouldn't say that. You know, we're all good at different things. But I love it because it's a full body invocation of the divine.
Yeah, and I think that's something that I'm coming to recognize as critically important, is to be more embodied with the divine. You got to use your body. You know, it's not rocket science.
Yeah,
you know. So anyway,
at Firefly Willows, LIVE, we're working hard to be your trusted source for fun, enlightening, and heart-centered information and community. And we're passionate about the art of transformative media, the new leading edge of communication in our highly connected, media-rich world. If you're passionate about facilitating change and you have gifts or ideas you'd like to share, come join us, host a show, or be a guest. Or connect us to an amazing speaker or teacher whose message is too good to miss. There's always room for courageous, knowledgeable changemakers, inspired artists, and new ideas. Let us know you're interested. Send an email to info@fireflywillows.com. We're Firefly Willows, LIVE, helping you find and shine your inner light.
Okay, so I wanted to ask you about your shamanic training, or the shamanic path. You're not a classically trained shamanic practitioner, but you do have a shamanic worldview. Tell us about that.
I do. From an early age, I understood and felt the consciousness of living beings. And I think shamanism is an umbrella term used in our world today. Traditionally, it was one who went into different realms and either received healings and wisdom about plant medicines or soul retrieval. A shaman was also someone who presided over rituals and pilgrimages and sang sacred songs. That would be the realm that I would consider myself a shamanic practitioner. I sing sacred songs. I lead ceremony with the drum. I create healing music. And I also receive information from the spirit realm.
As you're singing or in the process of leading ceremony? Just in general.
In general.
Well, you're so very connected with spirit.
Yeah, I'm connected to the tree. I'm connected to water. In my trainings, I have people listen to the sounds of living beings. I work with totem animals and I do medicine journeys, and I have received wisdom from medicine journeys. There's a council of grandmothers, the Great Grandmothers Council, that has been initiating me for the last 20 years. They're unembodied, but the Great Council of the Grandmothers, a form of the divine that makes itself known as these grandmother beings, and they have initiated me. So along with my work in the Akashic Records, I am very connected to what I would call the nature realm, the nature realm of spirit, also the elementals. I do the Paralandra healing. Do you know the...
No, share a little bit about that.
There's a woman who has land, and she calls it Paralandra, and she's created an entire coning healing process where you pull in the elemental energies. And I have, you know, connected to the fairy energies. That would be my druidic lineage, because I connect with the trees. I have a strong and powerful tree relationship and relationship with the ancient druid medicine.
Yeah.
And I have a strong Celtic vibration, and I think that
for the Celts, the shamans were the bards.
Yeah,
they were
I am a bard.
And dancers, yeah.
And I'm a song catcher as well. So that's what the American Indian tradition, and even the tradition, the Namibian shaking medicine tradition, and the Shakers and the Quakers, they are also song catchers. So they do their shaking medicine, and then they climb a thread up to the ancestral village, and they receive a healing or a song and bring it back.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been a song catcher since I was 11 when I wrote my first piece of music.
Yeah, yeah.
I've had teachers also, embodied teachers. Grandfather Wallace Black Elk, we did quite a bit of ceremony with him. And I also studied with people who studied with Harley Swiftdeer. I didn't study with Swift myself, but my husband was a blanketed apprentice, and we did a lot of work with, and still do work with Swift medicine. Slightly varied, because I am initiated by the grandmothers as well.
Yeah. We learn a lot from the spirits.
Once we learn a lot from the spirits. It's very true. And so that medicine, sweet medicine and the twisted hairs, has been very useful. Also, I carry bear medicine and otter medicine, which is fantastic because the otter is so joyful. But the bear had an amazing journey. And I was a relatively new mother, and I was very frightened about earth changes.
Huh.
And have always been since I was 12. That's when I became an environmentalist and really connected to the nature spirits when I was about 12. And I was just frightened for our survival. I thought, one day we won't have any gas, and then the trucks won't be able to bring the food, and the whole system is going to collapse. And I actually was living in a state of fear.
As a young teenager.
As a young person all the way through, and I had kids in my early 30s, and when, you know, I almost didn't have kids. I was so freaked out about the world I was bringing them into.
Mm.
And then I did a medicine journey, and I had been so frightened about the end of the world coming and I wouldn't know what to do, and Bear came to me. And I went into Bear, and I moved the way Bear moved, and she's so powerful, and she's so firm, and she looks to the side, and just so grounded. And she taught me that I would know exactly what to do for my cubs.
Yeah.
I had cross-country skied the John Muir Trail when I was 16.
Oh, wow.
It was a phenomenal trek. 28 days in the snow. Very difficult. I'd only skied once before, but I was, you know, mountaineer, kind of tough chick, did Outward Bound and all that, and I wanted to do that. And I learned how to build a snow cave. And we almost got caught in an avalanche and this whole drama. It was very intense. But the bear said to me, you know how to build a snow cave. You know how to hibernate. You will call upon your bear medicine, and you will protect your cubs, and you will know what to do.
Mm.
And I have not been afraid since.
That's very,
and
very
I am
powerful.
Thankful to Bear.
Yeah.
And I've been told by some of the native people here in our area that it's difficult for a woman to carry bear medicine. I'm not sure why, but there are three other women in my community that also carry bear medicine, and they're strong women. They're strong women,
yeah,
too. So
yeah.
I don't know why it's difficult to carry bear medicine, because the bear is such a good mother. She's such a fierce mother.
Fierce mother.
And you
yeah.
know you don't mess with a bear when her cubs, or you don't mess with a cub. You
right.
know the bear is not far away.
Yeah.
And I really, really give great thanks to the bear. And I honor her.
Mm.
She's a healer, too. She's a healer.
Oh, bear medicine is powerful healing medicine. It's not just about protection. It's healing medicine, too. Yeah.
Yeah, big time.
That's cool.
So
that's great.
I'm very grateful.
All right.
I'm very grateful to the medicine way, and you know, we live on this land, and I feel that it is our obligation to feel the teachings that come up through the ground and into us, because the native people here lived here so long, 50,000 years, you know, came over the Bering Straits, and they lived here so long, and they protected and preserved.
And
lived in harmony,
yeah, lived
with
in harmony.
Mother,
yep.
And respected. And, you know, 150 years we've managed to destroy it. And we were taught in the 1860s that all of this calamity was going to happen. And we didn't listen then. We were taught in the Dust Bowl in the 1930s. We were taught again in the 60s. You know, we keep not listening. Finally now, because it's critical, you know, we're listening. But the native teachings have been here. And I have great respect for that path. And very honored that I have been able to learn from the medicine way.
Yeah, we're lucky. We're lucky that they're still there and available to help us learn.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's important.
I'm a member of an organization called 1,000 Hummingbirds, which is a rainbow gathering. It was started by Ohlone women in this area.
And you had it recently, there was a gathering of that.
Yeah, we did a healing the waters ceremony. Down in China Camp near my house, and that was part of a global healing the waters ceremony that the 1,000 Hummingbirds admonished us to do in the month of May, which is when we traditionally would gather. We gathered for 4 years and held ceremony together. It was a group of women only, but this year we created ceremony right where we live.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very honored because a beautiful group of women came forward. Two of my lodge sisters were there. And I was able to do a Kivo invocation honoring earth, air, fire, and water.
Oh, that's great.
And then there was a song that I had written about the flowing waters that we also sang as we poured the water of the bay that we had blessed in the circle back into the bay.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really a beautiful ceremony. And I am honored to be a ceremonial singer in that way. And to play the drum in that way. And I really give great thanks to the native people of this land for giving us that path.
And for forgiving us for the
I don't know if they're forgiving us. They're having trouble. Some do, some don't.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
And I understand that, but I try to walk in the beauty way and live by their teaching.
you really can't go wrong with beauty.
Mm,
you know, it doesn't. It's one of those things that is becoming clearer and clearer to me, as the simplest advice is to cultivate beauty wherever you go. If that's what you do, you'll be successful.
Well, I really agree. My art has always been to create something beautiful. And I studied in the avant-garde, and I used to get really pissed off because they would force me, when I was in grad school, to listen to this music that conceptually was fascinating, but
wasn't beautiful.
I wanted to scream. I wanted to just run out of the hall and scream. And sometimes even with contemporary art, it just makes me so angry. There's enough ugliness. We can just go outside and look in the garbage heap and see that. And I know that art's supposed to be a reflection of culture, but isn't it also something more transcendent? So creating truth and beauty is a great, great import to me. And as an artist, I like functional art. So I've been really happy to create this healing art, you know, healing chants and healing movements and art for a purpose, not for its own sake. If we didn't live in a manufacturing world, I would be making a picture, or I'd be making an instrument, and it may be beautiful. Hopefully it would be.
Right.
I go and buy those things. So the art I make, at least I want to be beautiful and functional and to serve other people, because I believe in a life of service.
Yeah. And functional art is, you can only have so many art for its own sake. Yeah, you're right. You can only have so much art for its own sake in your space, but if everything that you have is also functional, then art can be everywhere. And I think that's part of the nature of artisanship, is about imbuing everything with art, you know, with the spirit of art. And I think you can't go wrong if you cultivate beauty wherever you go. You're going to do a lot of good in the world.
That's cool. I was just thinking about the bards. We were talking about the bards earlier, and they traditionally were the receptacles of the oral history.
Mm.
And so they were reciting and recounting the oral history of the tribe in a beautiful way that moved people. And that helped them remember. Rhythm and melody help people remember.
Yeah.
That's why children are taught songs early on, how to tie your shoe and the ABC.
Yeah.
Because they remember.
Yeah.
And I know that there were songs taught to Native children, or, you know, all children around the world, that teach them, but they're rhythmical.
Yeah.
And beautiful.
Yeah.
And beautiful functional art.
Beautiful functional art. That's a perfect example. Perfect example.
Yeah.
All right. Why don't we take a short break? And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about what you're doing.
Okay.
Would you like to share your shamanic life with our audience? We're always looking for featured guests who aren't just doing shamanism, but living it. If you've got stories to tell, let us know. Your stories can illuminate the path for others. If you're interested, contact us at facebook.com/shamanic life or send a message to Karen Armstrong, K-A-R-Y-N, at shamaniclife.com, or John Carosella, jc@fireflywillows.com. We're ready to listen.
Welcome back. I'm John Carosella, and this is A Shamanic Life. And I'm chatting with our featured guest tonight, Liz Addison, who is a magnificent vocalist, innovative composer, and creator of Kivo, a very fun, powerful, transformational dance, is that what you call it?
Yeah, I like to consider that I'm using song or vocal and movement as transformational tools, but also just opportunities to have a good time.
And it is really a great time. It's really fun. And earlier we were talking about you started to investigate cultures that had the same word for song and dance.
And I remembered the Mende word is doyiga.
Doyiga.
Yeah.
Oh, that sounds like a cool word.
Yeah.
And it sounds like a lot of them were in Africa. So you went to Africa.
I did.
Tell us about your trip to Africa.
I went to Africa because I had wanted to go since I was 5. And when my mother passed away, I inherited a little money, and I was able to go.
So since you were 5 years old, you wanted to go to Africa.
I didn't go.
What was the trigger?
Like, struggling artist, didn't have enough money to go, you know?
What was the thing inside you when you were little? Where did you feel that desire to go to Africa?
No, I just felt like I belonged there. We had a book on the table called The Tree Where Man Was Born by Peter Matheson.
Oh.
Big coffee table tree.
Book.
A book. Yeah. Coffee table tree. And also Jane Goodall was a factor in our lives. I just loved her. But I was always almost more interested in the forest than the chimps.
Wow.
So I ended up going. I've been a member of the Greenbelt Movement, which was started by Wangari Maathai in 1978. Most phenomenal woman. I think she and Jane Goodall are probably my two heroines of my life. She was the first woman in Eastern Africa to receive her PhD, which she did in biology, and then she went on to start the Greenbelt Movement, and that organization has planted 60 million trees in Kenya alone, and it empowers women. It's taught them organic and sustainable methods of harvesting and planting, and, you know, keeps the soil on the earth and the water on the earth, because bringing the trees back, which were all cut down when the, you know, our people went in and planted tea and coffee cash crops. And
So what was that trip like?
So I organized 5 trips.
Oh,
and
really?
That was the only one that stuck. Everything just lined up and converged. It was going with the Greenbelt Movement in Kenya and Roots and Shoots, which is Jane Goodall's tree planting organization in Tanzania. And I wanted to go to Mount Kilimanjaro and the Serengeti and Mount Kenya. So it all just happened. That was really where I wanted to go. And
was this the only one that was focused on the trees?
Yeah, that's the only one I've taken.
Mm-hmm.
I'm planning on going back, and you're welcome to come with me. We're going in July. Have a couple of projects there. One is to plant 1,000 trees in a school yard, because when I got there, there were about 250 kids playing with one soccer ball they'd fashioned out of T-shirts.
Wow.
And it was really dusty and dry.
Yeah.
So in order to give them some shade and some topsoil, we're going to plant 1,000 trees, and I'm taking donations for that. And then in Tanzania, they've asked me to return and start a Kivo Sew and Design Center to provide livelihood for women. And so I am also developing a little store there, and we will also be planting trees with every class that graduates.
Wow.
They taught me their songs and dances. They did. Everywhere I went, I was pulled into the villages, and they welcomed me with a Kivo-like celebration or welcoming song.
Did they know you were coming?
Well, of course they did, because I was communicating with the Greenbelt Movement and with Roots and Shoots and with a young man who started a safari company in Australia. And they set it all up for me. And we communicated by email. And I told them, yes, I want to do what you're offering, and I want to learn the songs and dances. And so they did. They set it up so I could.
That's fantastic.
It was phenomenal. It blew me away. I was in tears when I arrived, and I was in tears when I left. And just to be on the motherland of Africa, I cried. And to feel so welcome and at home, and it was so joyful, and we were all, you know, singing and welcoming and dancing, and I just felt like I was at home. I was blown away.
Actually,
we communicate by Facebook every day now.
Did the songs and the chants and the rhythms also feel like they were familiar?
Yeah, they're easy to learn.
But were they exotic to you?
Tanzania, actually, I taught a day at a girls' school, and that was such a rush because the teacher had requested that I send one of my songs and choreography to him, and it was the most African, kind of a high life one, and the chant is the Mababwa, so it's honoring the Ma for the mother, the Ba for the Papa, and the Bwa for Bwana, respect. It's also a water element. Bwa in French is to drink. So I'm showing them the choreography. You've got this section where the arms are opening and closing and opening and closing. And the girl says, Miss Addison, how did you know Swahili? I said, I don't know Swahili. And they said, Mabawa. Mabawa means wings in Swahili. And we thought you knew because of the choreography. I said, no, I didn't. So a lot of times I change that chant now from Mababwa to Mabawa.
That's
and I remember texting my husband going, well, I guess the spirits are having me channel Swahili now.
That's okay, man. That's
so
what
cool.
A beautiful synchronicity and powerful, too. And you do this here.
I do.
So tell us a little bit about the work that you're doing here.
Well,
the work I'm doing here is I do a lot of Akashic Record consultations and soul path work, helping people find their soul path. And through that process, if we do a one-on-one, I often will do some clearing or energy healing with the sound and the movement. So it's a specially designed one-on-one program that I have.
Right.
Then for those people that are interested in facilitating the kinetic voice, I have a program, and in that program there are, you know, sound healers and movement instructors and people like that who want to take that practice as part of their toolkit and either incorporate it in their classes, have their own practice, take it to children, take it to old people, that sort of thing.
Oh, so you teach them how to teach
it. I teach teachers. It's a professional development course. It's the Kiva Facilitators Training. And then I'm also starting to teach people how to open their Akashic Records. And I've been focusing lately quite a bit on assisting people in finding their soul path and then voicing it in the world. Because I'm all about the voice, and it's important to me that we clear the blocks. A lot of times, you know, people will come in and I'll see where the block is. And so we'll do some chakra clearing with the sound and the movement and releasing. The record keepers are phenomenal with helping support that growth.
Mm.
And so they help, you know, guide me. And then the intention is to clear the physical and energy bodies using sound and movement and with the wisdom from the records. I also work a lot with animal totems and other practices of that nature. We do a lot of listening to the nature spirits, matching our voice to that, speaking that which maybe we are afraid to speak. So it's all about bringing the voice forward in the world, and particularly the voice of the feminine collective, which I feel is so important to have heard at this time in history. It's crucial for our survival. So I'm really interested in helping women find their soul path, get in touch with their voice, clear the old traumas, and come forward and speak their truth, claim their space, own their worth.
So that brings up a couple of questions for me. One is, what is the nature of that voice that's coming forward? What does it sound like?
It's not one thing. Because the collective is comprised of individual voices. So it's each woman accessing her wisdom, harnessing the power of her voice, which is the sacred vibration that she came with, accessing that wisdom and voicing it, speaking in the world. And sometimes it's just important for women to be heard, because collectively, we have been shut down through lifetimes, for centuries. You know, we've been beheaded.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of stuck energy in the collective voice of the female and in the personal voice of the female.
Yeah.
I work with a lot of women who say, oh, I was, you know, 12 or 13, right at puberty, right? And some choir director or teacher or coach or somebody said, you can't sing, just mouth the words. Just mouth the words. So basically they're saying, you're not important, you don't count, shut up. Ah! And it's men too. I've heard that from men too. And I'm sorry if that has happened to you. Because we carry that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, the belittling you might have had as a child. I mean, it's subtle stuff, but it resounds. It's time.
Oh, yeah.
It's just time to let all that go. And my gifts are one way that's needed at this time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the other question I wanted to ask you about, which I think you kind of answered, is do you do this work for men as well?
I do.
And do you sense a gender-oriented difference in the blockages or the trend lines of what the women are dealing with versus what the men are dealing with?
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I just got this awareness, and partly from what you said. The men have a greater difficulty, I would say, in moving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's the freedom of movement.
Us gawky guys on the dance floor. So women have greater freedom of movement, and men have greater freedom of voice.
I see. The freedom, yes.
Yes.
Women most likely have more freedom moving the body.
Right.
And men have more freedom vocalizing.
Yeah.
I would say that's pretty cool. I never noticed that. Thanks, John.
Yeah, you're welcome.
The light bulb.
So I was asking about what's the sound of the communal feminine.
Collective.
The collective feminine.
The voice of the collective.
It sounds like the one thing that we can say is it needs to be heard. One generalization we can make is that it needs to be heard.
And valued. Honored, because it's the voice, you know, we're embodied, we women, we give birth.
Oh, yeah.
It's the voice of the earth speaking.
Yeah.
You know, speaking the pain and the victimization. I mean, I just did 1 billion rising. It was phenomenally powerful. One in three women globally will be raped or beaten in her lifetime. It's what we are doing to the sacred feminine as a race, or what we are doing to the feminine as a race.
Yeah.
And so that collective voice has been shut down, and it's coming forward. And, you know, maybe too forcefully at times. Sometimes that happens, you know, you come out, you know, too much to get it all out, and then we...
Okay, so we're about out of time.
Okay.
Are there any last thoughts you want to share about your, you know, the scope of what we've talked about, or your music, or the trees?
I feel like we've covered a lot. I'm really honored that you've asked me all these questions. It's really cool to have somebody ask and be interested in the work that I do. I've been kind of nose to the grindstone for a long time. I'm kind of a hard worker. And so it's time to come out of the studio a bit, not hide so much, and
dance in the street.
Dance in the street, yeah. I've done that. Dance in the street, get the music out, get the message out. Also, I've actually hidden that I've done this spiritual counseling and soul path guidance work and Akashic Records work. It's just not something I've gone out and advertised. So I'm really happy to have the opportunity to invite people to come and work with me, either as your soul path guide, work with kinetic voice or any blocks in sound or movement, and if you want to teach it, come and talk to me, or if you'd love to listen to some of my music, I'd be so happy for any and all of the above.
So where should we direct folks who want to get to know you more or your work more?
Well, I have a website, lissaddison.com, 1 S and 2 D's on my name. Liss is short for Phyllis, so it's not Liz, right? Not Liz, L-I-S. And that website has a music link, and it also has a couple of pages about Kivo, and a more detailed bit of information, reviews, and podcasts. I want to get this one up.
Okay.
And also, if you are interested in the Soul Path work, I have an email, liss@yourradiantsoulpath.com.
liss@yourradiantsoulpath.com.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I feel really fortunate to have found my path, and I want to help others find theirs as well.
Awesome. All right. So that's lissaddison.com.
Yeah.
And liss@yourradiantsoulpath.com.
Right. I also have liss@lissaddison.com if you just want to talk to me.
Okay.
That would be great. I'd be so honored. And thank you, John, for having me.
Thank you, Liss, for being on the show. And hopefully we'll have you on the show again. And
great.
We're going to have to do some, I want to get some more of your music on the show at
great.
Some point. So.
Like
all right.
That.
Thanks, Liss. And folks, we will be right back.
Hi, this is John Carosella, your host for A Shamanic Life. I hope you're enjoying the show. I love creating this show and sharing our guests with you. If you'd like to support the show, your contributions in any amount are gratefully received. If you'd like to help, send your contribution via PayPal to asl@fireflywillows.com. That's asl@fireflywillows.com. Sincerely, and with love and light, I thank you.
Welcome back. I'm John Carosella, and this is A Shamanic Life. And I'm here again tonight with Annette Wagner, visionary artist, creativity coach, and shamanic practitioner, talking about the vision plan. This is Vision Plan Episode 7.
That's
and
right.
We're going to talk about sharing. So, okay, well, let's talk about sharing. What's this panel about? And you know, give us some context, too.
So the context is we have answered the question about what our purpose is, what our passion and purpose is out there in the world. We've explored the idea of what our legend is, what people might be saying about us 5 or 20 years ago.
From now,
yes. Right. And we've spread our wings and said, what is our big dream that holds all of this together? Who are our beloveds that we serve out in the world? And what are our offerings?
Mm-hmm.
And now the question becomes, how do we take this back out into the world? How do we share these things out into the world? And sharing can be, you know, putting a posting up on Facebook. Sharing can be writing a newsletter. It can be a very practical set of things. It can also, depending on what you're doing in your vision plan, be something that's very personal. So if you're creating a vision plan around a project that needs to actually have a presence out in the world on the internet, you're going to look at things like your website, your Facebook, your LinkedIn, however it is you connect or share your information out into the world on the internet. If you're talking about something that is very personal, you might be talking about sharing what you're doing with a spouse or a partner.
Hmm.
You might be talking about sharing something with a class that you're teaching, or maybe with your professor. Say you're doing something around, you're in school and you're doing something in a graduate program where you're doing a thesis or a PhD dissertation or something. You could be sharing with your committee members. And it's, how are you sharing? And it can go anywhere from the kind of language that you're using to the medium that you use.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time when people write these things, I'm going to kind of read some of these off. If they talk, most of these times they end up being very specific, practical things. And actually, I want to back up slightly before I read you the list of things, is the other thing we want to think about on this panel is what the symbol is that represents sharing.
Yeah, okay.
So a lot of times, Shiloh Sophia McLeod, my teacher in this, the symbol she likes to use is bulbs.
Bulbs.
The flower bulbs. Like when you plant flower bulbs and you can see the bulb and you can see the bulb putting out roots and you can see the bulb beginning to grow green leaves up. And it's starting to share itself with the world, both going down into the soil and up into the air.
Yeah, yeah.
I tend to use pictures of flowers that might have seed pods, you know, sort of like a dandelion puff.
Right, right.
And you blow on, you make a wish and you blow on the dandelion puff and then all the little seeds go flying out into the world.
Yeah.
I tend to use that symbology because I like this idea of it just kind of lifting off into the winds, and the winds might take it in places where you have no idea it will land.
So the two things that come to me about sharing, about this panel, is one, that it's a verb,
mm-hmm.
right? It, whatever it is we're putting down here is really a call to action. You can't do the sharing panel without committing to a course of action.
This is absolutely true.
Right. And the other is that it involves you. Right. That action involves you, right? It really is I have to commit to bringing myself out or bringing my gifts forward, or, this verb is operating not in a vacuum. This verb is definitely operating on me.
Yes. And in fact, as one of my dear friends reminded me last night in a conversation where I was struggling with some shamanic energies flying through my life, it's about being visible, and you need to practice being visible when you're not comfortable being visible.
Mm,
so there's parts that we all have parts of our lives where we're not, where it's scary to stand in your own light. It's scary to believe in yourself and know you have work to do out in the world. And you can know it really strongly, but to take that step that moves that work out into the world and to share it with others, I mean, that risks disapproval. That risks all kinds of things.
You know, I want to spend a couple of minutes on this because, you know, people say that it's scary to stand in your own light, and stand in your truth and put yourself out there. And I don't think that we dig into that enough to understand what that really means, because we all, you know, most of the folks who are listening to this show are listening, are people that have gifts from spirit in some fashion. and we feel them, and we do, we actually do want to share them in the world. So it's not that putting them out in the world is scary. It's that we're not very sure about how to put them out in the world such that the effort will be rewarded. Right, and what's scary, I think, is doing a lot of work to present yourself or to present your gifts and, you know, throwing a party and having nobody show up.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's, and I guess I think that that's what's scary. It's not actually putting yourself out there. It's doing the work and then not reaping a harvest.
Yeah, and yeah, that is a very strong component of it.
Is there more? I mean, maybe there's more.
Well, I think there is for some people a scariness to simply standing in their light. There are people who feel deeply about something but simply aren't, it's not comfortable for their personality to stand out in their light. They're not extroverts. They're not, you know, or there's, it's hard for them to do that. And for some people, it, you really need to think about what the environment is that you're, how you're taking it out and where you're taking it out to and what you're doing. Sometimes for artists, it's, you know, absolutely terrifying to be at a reception for a show that they're in.
Why?
I think it's the disapproval or the, that they're afraid people are going to say they hate their artwork or they're, or sometimes they're simply, they don't like being out in public. Too many people in the room.
Okay.
So everyone has their comfort level about how much they're willing to do. But I think what you bring up is a very important point is for those of us who know we have gifts and we know we, Spirit is asking us to take them out into the world and to share them, there is this question about where best to invest our energy. And this is a tricky one for those of us who are doing this work because we don't know what works. The formulas that come over from, you know, our past jobs, like high tech in my case, they don't always apply.
I think this is really important. The first of all, marketing in general is, you know, not a very exact science. It's almost as dismal as economics, you know. And you know, there's this old saying that 50% of marketing dollars spent are effective. The problem is knowing which 50%.
Oh, absolutely.
Right, so it really is difficult. But I mean, now we are here in this place where we're working with Spirit and working with our muse to get guidance on sharing.
Uh-huh.
I mean, so shouldn't that make it easier? Shouldn't that make it more reliable or more trustworthy or something? I mean, no.
Well, if you can get me the shamanic decoder ring that helps me figure out all the messages from Spirit.
Well, okay, but I mean, like, I think where I'm poking here is the danger is in making this panel an exercise in shoulds and ego.
Yes. Yes, that is certainly part of it. Now, when you ask about, no, I mean, I, all my jokes about shamanic decoder rings to the side. Yeah. one of the things that people will do sometimes with this panel is they'll list off a whole bunch of stuff. And I'll, you know, give you an example of things I listed on the panel. I put my latest vision plan, which is about teaching the new work that I'm putting together, teaching the world. I said I wanted to share it with spiritual groups. I wanted to share it with some of the people I know in high tech. I wanted to create photos and artwork. I wanted to put it on Facebook and LinkedIn and newsletters and mailing lists and stories and posts. And I could tell I started to get into this, like, I started to list all the things I could think of that I should share it with.
Right, right, right.
So the next thing you want to do after you do that is to go into your spiritual practice, whatever it happens to be, and to start to ask questions like, well, which one really resonates? Which one feels like a chore? And which one really resonates? You know, get out your pendulum if that's something that you use.
Mm-hmm.
And go down the list of them and say, but which one do I work on first? Which one actually is going to help me share my work in the world most?
Right.
Ask Spirit. You know, to come give you a sign if that's something that Spirit will do. And play with them. Like, one of the pieces of advice that I've gotten is, you know, like, if I have, I'm trying to think of a good example of, like, an actual, so, like, if I have something that I want to go do, like, I have a website that I'm going to be posting things for, but it doesn't seem like people are connecting to it or that it's working, then the question isn't always necessarily, do I do something besides the website? Sometimes the question is, what else can I do within the website to get people to come there?
Mm-hmm.
Like, how much more can I play within this realm before I decide this channel isn't working?
Right. Well, that's the great mystery of marketing.
Yes.
Right.
And that's where I feel like in some ways we may have an advantage, although we may not always use it, which is to really have a conversation with Spirit about, well, what makes sense and what doesn't make sense. But keeping in mind that, as Spirit will do, is sometimes one thing will seem like it's working and then it's going to stop working. And you need to ask, is that because I stepped back from it, or is that because now my work's going in a different direction?
Right, right.
And also, Spirit, as we all know, is not logical.
Yes, and I think that's actually kind of the point I was trying to hinting at, is that the logical answers on this panel,
right,
may not be the, you know, that might not be the right thing to invest yourself in, and so how do you in the process of coaching folks through this panel keep them out of their left brain?
That's always an interesting exercise on this one, because these next four panels, the offering, the sharing, the abundance, and the connection, especially offerings and sharing, tend to put people down into their practical side.
Yeah, and that's okay. I mean, that's okay.
So let them, first thing I do is I simply let them think about all those things. So a lot of times when we're doing the vision plan, if it's something where I'm doing a longer workshop, I'll have them write down on a piece of paper to kind of do like a sketch of what they want the panel to look like, and just brain dump all that stuff in their head about all the possible places that they can go. And then to come back to this and say, now, write down the ones you really think you're going to do. Don't worry about whether you should do or not. Actually write down the ones that you actually say, yes, I'm willing to go out and write a blog post.
Right.
Yes,
right.
I'm willing to go make a post, to create an event, put it on my Facebook page. Or, yes, I'm willing to go change the way I talk to that professor about this project. Whatever it happens to be, put down the ones that you actually are willing to make a commitment about.
Mm, yeah.
And think about the language of what you're willing to do. So sometimes what we also do on this page, depending on how detailed people want to get, is you might say, I'm going to write a blog post once a week.
Okay.
You know, like have an actual action. This is the most action-oriented of the panels.
Yeah.
So it is the place to really think about, what am I going to do? How am I taking this out? How am I sharing?
Mm-hmm.
It can also include where you're doing this.
Oh, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm.
So, like, I wrote down spiritual groups, and when I was showing John earlier, I have one of the very first vision plans I ever did, and one of the questions we asked was, well, where are you doing your work? And that's another piece that can come into play here on this panel, is part of sharing your work is where you're sharing your work. Are you sharing your work? Do you have an office? Are you going to rent an office space and then this is the place where you're going to share it? Are you sharing it via a radio show on the air? Are you sharing it via a website?
Yeah.
Think it's many different levels and threads of thinking about how this work is going to go out into the world. And sometimes we don't spend enough time on this panel. We think, oh, we'll write down Facebook and LinkedIn. And
yeah, see, that's what I'm actually looking at the panel that I created here. And it's really, the symbology on it is really soft. It's just these concentric circles of blended color. And I'm thinking about that as sort of this radiating sense of self, right? And I haven't put any words down here, but I want to come back to the symbol, right? Because there's power in the symbolism, and I'm toying with, I'm exploring, like, what are the different symbols that make sharing, that create this panel, that cast this panel in different ways, right? So you talked about the bulb,
mm-hmm,
right, as grounded and then showing up,
yes,
in the world. You talked about the flower with the
seed pods.
With the seed pods that are blow in the wind. This one is more like the one I just described that I put down is more like just this this emanation, this glowing, emanating kind of function.
Well, and I liked what you said about it being a radiating sense of self, because while the viewers can't see it, I can see the little self that you drew on the panel.
Right, on the other panel.
Right.
Right.
So, and it connects in, they connect each other.
Right. And so I guess I would want to encourage people in thinking about their sharing to make an effort to feel it, to feel, yeah, help me out here, because this is really important, and I you know more about this, and you've been through this a lot more than I have, of course. There's something about this panel that just screams list of bullet points.
Mm-hmm.
And I, that somehow feels like it misses the key here.
You're doing wonderfully, by the way.
Like there's some magical thing about sharing that is almost intangible and inarticulable.
Yes, and this is, for me, the word that comes up on this panel is always resonating. It's when I come into resonance with how I'm supposed to take this out. It's that feeling of, yes, I can list off all the bullet points, and then I can take it another level, and I can say, oh, I might actually do this one. And then you take it another level, and you go, yeah, that one.
Yeah, okay, that's the process. That resonance is a great word for this, because I want to, whatever I put on this panel, I want it to be the thing that I'm not doing because I have to.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing because I can't resist it.
Exactly.
I'm compelled by the beauty and truth of its appropriateness.
Yes. Now, I want to put in one little piece with that, because I think that is that's the kind of, what you've described is the things you're going to put on the panel that you're going to go out and do now. I want you to pay attention to the things that have attraction for you, but you're not sure exactly why.
Yeah.
Because they may be the things that are sitting on the sidelines waiting to come in and manifest.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, one of the things that had been a bit of a, I had this attraction with, was getting back into blogging about my story.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just stayed aware of the thread. And then when the opportunity came, I just started writing things.
Right.
And I wasn't necessarily posting them. And then came a point where it felt like it was more in resonance, and I started posting more.
And so what was that emergence? What was that emergence like inside you? Where did you feel it inside you? Did you feel it in your solar plexus, in your second chakra, in your throat? Where did you feel that?
I think it probably was really coming up from more second chakra and going up. I mean, it was during a time when I was having healing work, and it was about getting back into connection with something very deep inside me.
Hmm.
I have to remember, for me, writing is something that I know I can be very good at, but it's, how to say, it's almost like a deeper connection inside my body than where I paint from.
Oh, that's interesting.
It's painting is almost like opening a channel to spirit, and this creature comes and lives on my canvas, and they tell me what to paint them, how to paint them.
Right. Uh-huh.
Right. The writing is different because it uses more of my voice. So there's an interesting kind of, it feels different in how I connect inside of myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I have to move into a place of vulnerability, and I have to give myself space to do that. One of my friends, some of the women I know who go out and do this on a regular basis, say that sometimes you just need a little bit of white sheets therapy. And white sheets therapy refers to the practice of checking yourself into a hotel room and just writing for 24 hours.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Because you do it like a retreat. You just step away from everything else, buy yourself a dozen roses, a bag of groceries or chocolates or whatever the heck you think you need, take your computer and just
I kind of think I need some white sheets therapy.
It's a wonderful thing to do.
Especially the chocolates. That sounds like really good.
For me, at least, it's the idea of to be in resonance with, to really get to that point of resonance, I need to get everything else quiet for a while.
Yeah.
Now, I'm also a triple fire sign, so.
Sure. So it's going to be different for everybody, but I think that's, if I could encourage or leave our listeners with that one thought that works powerfully for me on this panel, is that it really has to be about the resonance, not about the tactics.
Yeah.
Because otherwise it's like any, it's just a list.
Yep. And it'll be a list that'll stick on your refrigerator, and it won't get thrown away when the groceries get picked up, but it's going to be that kind of list, and then it doesn't have meaning.
Right.
So we want this to be, resonant, something that resonates and has meaning, and that you're going to wake up in the morning and say, I'm going to go do that today.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Okay. Well, is there anything else we want to share about sharing?
Not right now.
Okay, and if folks want to get to know you and your work a little better, where do we send them?
You can send them to my website, which is AnnetteWagnerArt.com.
And next time, we're going to be talking about...
Abundance.
And so everybody's going to want to tune into that one. All right, thanks so much, Annette. We'll see you next time. And we'll be right back.
Yes, we've added to our lineup of lively, thought-provoking shows. But don't forget... our original Sunday morning lineup at 10:30 a.m. Join us for Healing Conversations with Mildred Lynn McDonald every first Sunday. Revolution with Heisey Lutmers every second Sunday. Convergence with John Carosella every third Sunday. And our popular on-air call-in show, the fourth Sunday of every month. We're excited. Give us a listen as we continue to create new and entertaining ways for you to shine your inner light. Join us at Firefly Willows, LIVE.
Welcome back. I'm John Carosella, and this is A Shamanic Life. Last night in Santa Cruz at the Rio Theater, Josh Fox, the maker of Gasland, screened his latest version, Gasland Part 2. And you can find this film and information about it at gaslandthemovie.com. And if you're not familiar with this story, it's about the process of hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, which is a technique for extracting oil or natural gas resources from certain kinds of geologies. In particular, shale, deep subterranean shale formations. And, this technique has come under scrutiny lately, largely because of guys like Josh Fox, and in particular Josh Fox in the movie Gasland, where he showed the damage that occurred in many people's lives, in particular to their groundwater, because of poorly regulated gas drilling and hydraulic fracturing or fracking on land that's either their land or on nearby land. And, a lot of times we don't see this stuff coming, and when we do see it, it's too late. But this time, we have different resources at our disposal, and we do have the chance to participate in shaping policy and making a difference. So this is our activist segment tonight, and I'm really inviting you to listen carefully and think about the ways that you can get involved, because we really do all need to speak up and make our stand here. The environment that we're working in is tilted in favor of the industry that exploits. And the reason I say this, for one, maybe it goes without saying, maybe it's obvious. But I think it's worth pointing out that it's also part of the long history of what's gone on this continent. You know, it's and that was just actually mentioned in the film and in the dialogue that after the film last night with Josh and his team, that on this continent we have a long history of resource extraction, exploiting resources without regard for the consequences to the people who are on the land. And of course, this is what happened to the native peoples that were here, the indigenous Native American people. But now it's actually happening to us. It's happening to European descendants, white folks, middle class, and sometimes upper middle class, because the attitude and the alignment and the money is so strongly tilted in favor of the resource extraction. And of course, the resource extraction industries, in particular the energy companies, have tremendous leverage in government because they can spend unlimited amounts of money in favor of particular candidates, especially with the recent Supreme Court's decision called Citizens United, which said unlimited corporate money without regard for even it doesn't even have to be disclosed. So, and there's a lot going on there, and it really does call all of us to get involved. So I can't stress this enough that we need to get involved. But first, I want to highlight what's this about, and I have some clips from the question and answer session from the screening last night. This is about natural gas. So let's listen to Josh Fox talk about why natural gas.
Natural gas that they're drilling for is used for power generation. California is one of the highest uses of natural gas for electricity. So in that sense, solar and wind power can easily replace it. I started with Mark Ruffalo, the Incredible Hulk, the green superhero, and a banker named Marco Propels from Rabobank, and a scientist from Stanford, Mark Jacobson, a plan called the Solutions Project, which Mark Jacobson, this incredible, genius renewable energy planner, planned out how you could transform all of New York State, all of the country, and all of California in particular with these plans onto renewable energy for every use.
Okay, so there's a statement that there are alternatives, and that there are not just alternatives in theory, but there are alternatives in plan that we can take the opportunity to support and dialogue about and promote and share. So we have to think about this from, you know, from the perspective of those who are going to object or differ with us, right? There's going to be a statement, many statements about the necessity for fracking, for access to natural gas as a part of the lifeblood of our economic system. The truth of the matter is that this is all about priorities. And if we chose to spend our country's wealth, invest it in renewables instead of things like fracking and large natural gas ports that are designed to export natural gas, we'll talk about that in a minute, and for heaven's sakes, the wars that we've been spending money on, you know, we've spent over $1 trillion fighting battles that, you know, are really driven by the resource extraction economy. In Iraq and in Afghanistan, yes, those were terrible administrations. You know, the leaders of those countries, the political systems in those countries created a lot of terror for and a lot of trauma for their people. But in large measure, those functions were there as a result of the kinds of behavior that we are compelled to because of our dependence on fossil fuels. So if instead of trying to solve the problem of access to fossil fuels by creating stable environments in the areas where fossil fuels are so that we can extract them, if we had decided instead to spend $1 trillion on revamping our infrastructure so that we didn't need them, it would make the whole situation moot. The other compelling and concerning thing about the desire to exploit natural gas through the process of fracking is that you will hear that we need it for our economy. But the truth is that there are plans to build 7 liquid natural gas ports for shipping natural gas extracted from this country overseas, in particular to the markets in Asia. So we need to be really careful. And this is also true of the Keystone XL pipeline. We need to be really, really careful to consider thoroughly the real motivations behind the programs and the plans that we're being asked to support with our, you know, through our politics and through our tax dollars. So you know, just this is the part of this is about being educated and being awake to the nuances and to look behind the headlines. And I want to emphasize something here too. I don't believe that it's appropriate for us to be alarmist and for us to be to rage at one another or to rage at the other side, because that doesn't make progress. It doesn't engage. We need to engage, but we need to engage with as many facts in our pockets as possible. And so it really behooves us to be as educated as possible. And one of the things that we need to understand is what is the nature of hydraulic fracturing. And again, from the meeting last night, I want to play this little clip for you.
There's a lot of different chemicals involved. What you have to do to carry frac sand down, if you'll notice on the beach, water doesn't really carry sand. So you have to make that water very thick. It's got to have a viscosity to it. So you put in a thickening agent, and that water becomes like a gel when you're injecting it for the frac. Then what you need to do is get that water out of the way really fast so that it's slippery and lubricated so that the gas or oil can flow very quickly. So they insert another chemical, and boom, presto chango, you've got a liquid that's very, very light, frothy, and out, like the stuff they put in the jet engines to make sure the pistons don't stop firing, you know, very, very lubricated and slippery. Then you have to have biocides, because if you just spent, you know, $10 million drilling a well, you don't want your iron and your steel pipe to corrode. You don't want the biological material or the anaerobic bacteria that live without any oxygen to start corroding your pipe. So you put down formaldehyde, or you put down hydrochloric acid. Like you saw those big Halliburton trucks going through LA, on the front they were placarded, it said acid. Yep. So these are the kinds of uses of the chemicals. And these chemicals are very, very sophisticated, and a lot of them are proprietary. Theo Colborne, our Rachel Carson, at her website, TEDx.org, the endocrine disruption exchange.org, TEDx.org, has a list of all the chemicals that she has discovered that are known. You saw her in the first gas den, perhaps. And they're categories. So some of them are cross-linkers, some of them are biocides, some of them are lubricants, some of them are solvents. The drilling muds themselves are made out of petroleum distillates, light petroleum distillates, in cases bariums, things that lubricate the drill bit as it's going down so that it doesn't overheat and crack off and break. All of these things. There is no fracking without those toxic fluids. It doesn't exist. The Halliburton will come out and say, oh, we have non-toxic fracking fluids. It's not true. It's PR. It's a deceitful lie. There is no such thing as non-toxic fracking. And even if they did develop someplace in the future non-toxic fracking fluids, the whole suite of those chemicals, and all of a sudden they change them over for a whole suite of chemicals that are non-toxic, the oil itself is toxic. You know, all the stuff down there, the heavy metals, the salts, the polynuclear aromatic hydrocarbons, all those things are coming right back up. So when you created that conduit through the water table, through the ground, it doesn't matter if it's toxic going down, it's toxic coming back up. But in this case, in every well that's out there, toxic going both ways. And again, they're exempt from the Safe Drinking Water Act. They can inject toxic materials directly into the ground all across the state, California, all across 34 states, and not report it to anyone.
Okay, so this is what's one of the killer things that's wrong or bad about hydraulic fracturing or fracking. And that is that they pump thousands and thousands and thousands of gallons of highly chemicalized, highly treated water, so that they consume between 400 and 600 trucks of water that they pollute with these very sophisticated chemicals. They inject them into the ground under really, really high pressure to crack open the shale. And then they pull that water back out and supposedly dispose of it safely. But 400 to 600 trucks of water go into a well, 200 to 300 come out, which means that 200 to 300 truckloads of highly toxic water and chemicals remain in the ground. And while this the fracking layer is typically significantly lower, deeper than the water table, here's the thing that's just absurd. The technology to ensure that that water doesn't come, and or the oil or the gas doesn't leak into the groundwater layer, is a cement casing around a well pipe. And studies have shown that the cement casing around oil wells or gas wells fails in 5% of the well cases of drilled wells immediately, as soon as the well becomes operational. And over the next 30 years, 50% of those well casings will fail. And when those well casings fail, the extracted materials, whether it's natural gas or oil, and the fracking fluids travel up that fractured casing and into the groundwater, into the aquifer. And once those chemicals are there, they're there for a geologic age, typically. So we're really talking about the absolute destruction of our freshwater system. Now, this is how could anybody be this insane? Well, it's what it is. It's a kind of programmatic, corporatized insanity, a soulless psychopathy that is engendered by our corporate structures. They just do it because they can and because they're programmed to make money. So this is really bad news. It's really bad news. And we kind of have to be firm. And we don't kind of have to. We have to be absolutely firm about this. The problem is that there's no regulations that can solve this problem, because the well casings will inevitably fail. And once they fail, the damage is permanent. So we can't really regulate this, and we can't really find halfway solutions here. I want to play one more clip here from Josh on this point.
And we had very strong bills, moratorium bills, and there are a lot of organizations, California's Against Fracking, Food and Water Watch, fighting for a ban or a moratorium. As you saw in the film, these efforts can get diluted, they can get fracked, destroyed by the oil industry's influence on government. This is a moment when you can't compromise. Compromise often is a good thing. Compromise is often, you know, eat half of your broccoli, you know. But what I'm saying is that on this issue, regulations won't protect you. I've seen, as you see in Pennsylvania, you got the strongest regulations in the country in Pennsylvania. The strongest regulations in the country in Colorado. The strongest regulations in the country in Texas. We've heard this over and over and over and over and over again. It doesn't protect people. It's kind of like your state regulatory agency, picture the DMV, you know. It's like the DMV versus ExxonMobil.
It's like the DMV versus ExxonMobil. There's no way that our public servants stand a chance against the kind of wealth and power that are wielded by corporations. So that means that we can't entrust this to overseers. It means that we have to stand firm and say no. And I think it's really important that we acknowledge that we can't pass the buck this time. We can't pass the buck to others. We can't ask others to do this work for us. This is where buck ultimately lands on the desk of each of us. The buck stops here with each of us. And it stops with each of us for one very fundamental reason. We vote. And it's quite possible that the corporate lobbyists can press to write laws, and the corporate promoters can fund candidates. But at the end of the day, you cast the balance. And that's and you have neighbors, and you have Facebook, and you have Twitter, and you have email lists. And it really comes down to whether you are willing to step into the arena and make an effort. And before you say, well, you know, we can't possibly win, I want to play this clip for you.
Have other countries stopped drilling yet? France banned fracking. Well, I mean, the French like to protest. If the espresso is too cold, they're like, we're going out, we're going to protest. But they really did this through popular uprising in France and made it a huge issue. In Bulgaria and Romania, I understand there are bands that are very strong that are moving forward, and they're constantly getting challenged, right? It's only temporary victories. In South Africa, they had moratoriums. We're seeing German beer makers rise up. Don't crack our beer. So there's a lot of stuff going on in Europe, and there's in Vermont. Vermont was the first state to ban fracking. They don't have any shale, but they banned fracking anyway. We saw a ban bill reach Governor Christie's desk with a supermajority, and Chris Christie vetoed it. But what this means is that worked at the legislative level. We also have seen this stop in New York, as you saw in the film so far. In the Delaware River Basin, we won. How did we win? Because we were going to shut down that meeting that was going to pass regulations, and they knew it. So this has happened other places. And partially it's because, in New South Wales in Australia, they have a campaign called Lock the Gate. You saw this in the film. They literally locked the gates to the gas companies and held like month-long sit-ins where they were just hanging out.
So we can take our country back. We can. You know, do you know why the German beer makers are protesting this? In Germany, there's rules about what can be in beer. And there's only like five ingredients that are allowed to be in German beer. And if the water is contaminated, they can't make beer with it. So their whole, you know, it sounds funny, but it's really important that everybody look at the consequences of something as fundamental as having our water source polluted in such a fundamental way. It's really staggering. So we are being called to be the keepers of this land, and you know, and we can do it. We can. We have the technology now. The tools that we have at our disposal, social media, social networks, awareness, we can change the wind, and that's what changes the minds of the politicians. Change the wind when everybody says, and you know, yeah, we're having a lot of trouble with this, even things like genetically modified food. 90% of Americans want GMO labeling, and we don't have it yet, but it's coming. We are making this change happen, and we can do it. Now, and you know, I want to share, because this is where the tie-in for me to the Native American thing. I sat in that theater last night and felt an incredible sense of despair. I felt like these people are insane. And I can't stop them. And I wondered, is that what our Native American brethren and their ancestors felt when the Europeans came and started tearing everything up? Liz Addison said, you know, we heard from the native peoples that disaster was coming in the 1960s. We saw it in our own communities in the Dust Bowl in the 1930s. Our unsustainable way of living, it keeps being, we keep being reminded of it in more and more intensely volatile and provocative ways. It happened again in the 60s, and it's happening now with fracking in Pennsylvania, in Colorado, in Texas, in Wyoming. So we got to shake ourselves out of this. But I'll wrap, because I fear that I may be keeping you long. We are the ones that we've been waiting for. The responsibility is in our hands. Our prayers will be answered, but we do have to do the work. And I just want to share this one other thing that Lance Simmons, who was the part of the Pennsylvania Environmental Protection Bureau, had what works and what we have to do.
So we have to do all of the, let's borrow a line from Obama. We got to do all of the above. All right. We got to do the local stuff. We got to do the individual stuff. We got to do civil disobedience. We got to do it all, because they need to hear you. Because remember, I always say this, they work for you. You don't work for them.
They work for you. You don't work for them. Let's make them understand that very clearly.
Living a shamanic life is about more than drumming, rattling, and journeying. It's about living in harmony with the spirits and the earth. Sometimes that means caring enough to take action. If you know someone who is walking the talk and feel we should hear their message, let us know. We love to highlight activists who are doing their part to embrace our spirit-filled world and live a shamanic life. Contact Karen Armstrong, K-A-R-Y-N, at shamaniclife.com, or John Carosella, JC, at fireflywillows.com. We'd love to hear from you.
All right, so that's our show for tonight. I want to thank you for joining us. I apologize for that technical glitch. I hope you take away a few thoughts and insights about taking your gifts out in the world from tonight's show, and taking the world, or at least a small part, some small part of it, under your wing. We're living in powerful, transformative times, and you are here on the planet for a reason. Know your gifts. Find a way to share them. If you want help discovering your soul path or your gifts, help is available from folks like Annette Wagner, Liz Addison, and others. Take advantage of and support your local holistic practitioners. You know, we're all in this together. There are, as you probably know, hundreds of worthy causes that would welcome your time and resources. It just takes you to jump in. And sometimes prayer and vigilance are required, as both Josh Fox and Chief Arvel Looking Horse are calling us to. So spread the word. It's our world. It's our home. And our children and their children and their children's children are counting on us. So again, thanks for joining us. Until next time.
Thank you for joining us. This program was brought to you by Firefly Willows LIVE. We hope you enjoyed the show. This is Deb Carosella. Please join us next time on Firefly Willows LIVE for What's Your Prescription for Balance with Mildred Lynn McDonald and Dr. Glenna Calder, Thursday afternoon at 3:30 p.m.